And when we have people with questions, that's how we start the class. And the questions, I enjoy questions. And I encourage people to ask questions. Because it brings out, it actually turns into a good talk and very beneficial. So as I answer your questions, I hope everybody else thinks of things, well, what about, or I don't know, I don't understand this or that. And that way everybody can get a lot of information. Okay, well,
they're kind of generic questions. What I'm doing is just basically writing a paper for a class that I'm taking. So, I hope that I'm not too generic with my questions. And some of them are aimed personally to you, and some are general. One of the first ones I have is, how long have you been a Buddhist?
Oh.
That's one that you
know. I don't know. I'm 62 and I was Buddhist when I was 12.
Okay. Long time. How did you come to your belief book? You saw that one.
Well, this is the first time I've done it.
I chose these questions if it helps at all. This wasn't...
I think it's how they approach, somebody who's never been to a Buddhist temple. That's,
The core of your belief system, what exactly does that involve?
Have you read anything about Buddhism?
A little bit, yeah.
If you ask what the beginnings of any religion or spiritual philosophy, they all come down to the same thing. And that is trying to answer questions that we can't answer. From the Buddhist, the Buddha was interested in questions we can't answer. So he was interested in what is actually behind that. And that is life stops. You're born, you grow old, you get sick, and you drop dead. You don't know what happens after you're dead, so you speculate. Because life is like that. And of course, now with technology, we have better doctors, and we live longer, and we're a little healthier. And sometimes living longer is not that good, but at the time of the Buddha, and the time of that other religious philosophies came into being, people didn't live very long. Probably the average age is probably about between 40 and 50. So, why is life like this? Why are there hurricanes? Why are there earthquakes? Why are there floods? Why are there volcanoes? Why are there tsunamis? Why is there disease? What are we standing on? What's up there? How big is it? And all of this impacting on people's lives. So the question was, the answer is, the question really is, why is life the way it is? And there must be more than this. Because when you die, what happens when you die? Is it eternalism or annihilation? Either you're annihilated or you're eternal. So all religions had to answer that question. And they answered it in different ways. The Buddha said speculative views or knowledge about things we don't understand or speculation about it is not useful. If you don't know, you don't know. Shelter. So he said, well, life, from his observation of mind and body, he was not interested in rites or rituals or prayer or deity. He says, those are things that are not important to human beings and how we live. From his observation of body and mind, he says, well, yeah, life sucks. Well, it sucks because that's the nature of body and mind. It's the very nature of body to fall apart, grow. And no amount of prayer, sacrifice, or belief, or faith is going to change it. For everybody across the board, period. Every creature. So, just why do we suffer stress? That's the problem, stress. Stress from our own minds and stress from our own body. And that's the question that all religions try to answer. That's the reason there are religions, because of stress. If we didn't grow, we didn't get sick, we didn't die, there weren't diseases, there weren't bugs, there would be no religion, no use for it. But because these things happen to us and we want to know why, and this is we're genetically programmed for this stupid question. Because we have the human brain, unlike animals, sees itself in the past and future as an I, me, see me in the future. And it also has this anthropomorphic tendency which makes things are alive. Things must feel as I feel. And that programming was perfectly good for a troop of human beings trying to cooperate and hunt woolly mammoths. But it's not good for religion, because it does the same thing. It imagines things as being what they are. And since the mind is finite, you can only imagine in a certain way, they always come up basically the same. So that doesn't really answer the question. It really says it's like that because something out there, you know. So the Buddha said, well, no, stress from watching the mind, looking at the mess, the whole mess of stress and the mess we're in is because we simply don't look at our own minds. Our own minds cause the stress, and it's caused us to craving and clinging to things that are not true. And this craving, clinging, especially craving and clinging to things that are true, meaning body and mind, if he wasn't really interested in. If we crave and cling to the idea that Earth is flat or it's round, or the universe is finite or infinite, it doesn't matter. You know, when you stub your toe, it's not going to matter. When you get sick, it's not going to matter. When you go to work, it's not going to matter. It's not going to matter picking your partner in life. It's not going to matter how you raise your kids. It just don't matter. But what does matter is the self-generated stress, because we're hanging on to things that are simply not true. Someone who hangs on to eternalism, the idea of eternalism, is simply not true. Or annihilationism, the Buddha also says it's not true. So the after-death thing falls into those two categories. You're either annihilated as an atheist, agnostic, and non-religious people, or you're eternalist after most days. But this doesn't solve the problem. So is it craving and clinging things that are not true, not understanding body and mind is a big problem. And the way to solve it is a systematic method of reduction or radical empiricism. In other words, looking at your own body and mind and knowing what you can know, you know, and what you can't know, don't bother. So it goes in steps. It is that analysis of body and mind yourself. You don't have to worry about other people's bodies and minds. So, you know, everybody's the same mess, but we don't have to get into other people. So this analysis shows you how the mind works, what causes its stress, how to abandon stress, and how to have knowledge replace stress. And knowledge meaning wisdom. If you understand something, you can let go of it. As a mathematician has a huge formula on the board, chalkboard, works on it for years and years, and just can't let go. But when they solve it, there's a feeling of euphoria, and they can say, I'm done. In the same way that someone has these realizations about their own body and mind, they have this euphoric feeling, and the stress of that problem just disappears because you find the stress, the solution. And you have insight into what is your problem. So the whole of the Buddha's teaching is understanding what stress is, understanding what causes it, and understanding the way to get rid of it. And then the practice is getting rid of those things. People are not trained in this way in the West. And so we don't get rid of it. We collect it, or we kill it. we dope it, or we entertain it, or we cover it up, instead of just pyramids like they do with a soldier. They run to the front lines and there's another army, and they say, ooh, this is, I just run the other way. The Buddha had a lot of trouble becoming enlightened and a lot of suffering that he had to go through. But the one thing he did not do was escape into fantasy. He didn't make up mythology for what he didn't know. He said, okay, I want to know what stress is. I want to know what's cure. Like a doctor. It's often called Kesajak Guru, which means doctor. And that is, if you have a doctor, you go to the doctor says, he has to know what's wrong with you. You go to a doctor, I don't know what's wrong, I have no idea. Well, you switch doctors, yes, another doctor. The doctor says, I know what's wrong with you, I know its cause, I have the medicine, you take it, here's the cure. That's a complete cure, that's the doctor's complete cure. If at any one point he stops and says, I don't know, then you find somebody who does. So it was the disease is stress, the disease is suffering and stress and pain, body and mind. The cause of it is craving and clinging to non-reality and not facing it head on, not understanding it, not abandoning it. The cure, it's curable. And then he goes on to say, this is curable and this is how you do it. This is the medicine. So that's Buddhism in a nutshell. It's not like other religions, and this is why it's often argued it is not a religion. And it depends on how people define religion. I personally think it's not a religion. It has no God, nothing to do with God. And it's the only religion in the world that's like that. Even the cult of the flying spaghetti monster has a spaghetti monster. So the Buddha basically threw out all of those things and said, it is empirical in that what does something do? You have to have the mind brave enough to ask the questions and brave enough to see the result. So it has to be a scientific mind. So if you do, all the studies that have been done on all the booga booga of the world, you know, have proved that it doesn't work. And still, in spite of that, people continue with mythology. So the Buddha was raised in a mythology. He was raised a Hindu. There's no such thing as Buddhism. In fact, the word Buddhism came about in the 1940s. And nobody in a Buddhist country called it Buddhism. Only in the West. It was Burma. In Thailand we call it Sasana Buddha, right? The teaching of the Buddha. What do they call it in Burma? The same? Because you don't say Buddhism, right, in Burma. Yeah, the same one. Yeah. And in Sri Lanka, what do you call it? Do you call it Buddhism, or what do you call it?
Buddhasasana.
Buddhasasana, yeah. The teaching of the Buddha. Thai turns it to sasana Buddha. Buddhasasana, the same word. Nobody says Buddhism. I know where the ism came from. But it means the teaching of the Buddha. He didn't make it a religion. He simply said, this is my teaching. And then he taught Dhamma or Dharma, as everybody calls it in the West. And Dharma simply means law or truth. So, what does Buddhism believe? It believes reality. It believes what is something in and of itself, what is the realness of it, by being objective. And to be objective is not anything, by any means easy. Because as I said, we're hardwired for nonsense. We really are. You grow up in a culture, okay, your family does things to you, starts you on your way. Not all good. The culture teaches you things. We have a tremendous desire to belong to a group. Right? I'm Jewish, I'm Catholic, I'm Irish, I'm German, and that includes religions, it includes races. It includes, I eat this kind of food. Oh, I'm Hungarian. Well, I'm Croatian. People have none of those things. But the mind does that. The mind automatically receptive. Monkeys do it. Apes do it. It's a great thing I saw on it. This kind of this Animal Planet or something I was watching. And a baby zebra, falls into the mud and loses its stripes. And its mother and all the other zebras kick it and run away from it in terror. We do that.
You're going, oh, that's terrible.
We do that. We do that, the same thing. And it rained very hard and the mud washed off and they took it back. There you are. Oh, they're animals. They're shallow. They're stupid, right? Change of color so we look. We're hardwired for that. So not only do you have to get over your conscious, which you're aware of, your subconscious, you have to understand that and how that means you work. And your hardwired instincts that you're born with, you have to get through that. And then you have to get with your primal mind, which just says, I will exist at all costs. And if that means eating my kids, I'll do it. Everybody thinks we're so, you know, we're humans. Oh, we're marvelous things. There are one-cell beings in the world, which, of course, we owe our existence to. We're sophisticated, right? But you strip us down and boil us and peel us and get to the core, and you have that same drive and craving that a one-cell being has, and that is, I will exist at all costs. I will pass on my DNA. Then you add layer and layer and layer and layer and you come to a human being. But in the end, people can do anything. So it isn't that easy. When you think about what the Buddha did, he went through all those things and got to the core and said, it's this stupid craving and clinging to me. I am divine. I am an individual. I am special in the universe. That's what causes the trouble. The selfish, just egotistically, narcissistic, selfish. So Buddhism is not something that likes faith. Something that knocks down walls, goes through walls, plunges in, opens doors. If somebody says, you know, the Buddha said, you go to the internet, you'll find a whole bunch of things. This, according to Buddha, the Buddha said, and they often spell Buddha, B-U-D-D-A, or the Buddha, you know, Buddha. And it's nonsense. A lot of it is just horrendous nonsense. Then people just make it up, I guess. I don't know. Real Buddhism is easy to find. It's easy to the mechanics is easy. But it's your own mind that's your enemy. It doesn't want to know those things. Intelligent design. That's a double book. A 10-year-old could design a better body. One of our monks is having trouble with his teeth. Because there's too many teeth in our mouth. Our jaw is not long enough for all the teeth. It makes a mess. The back is poorly designed. Child labor is painful because we're not designed right. You're wearing glasses out of intelligent design. So to look at Buddhism, the whole of Buddhism is looking at, trying to see reality. But not the reality out there. It's not important. That runs on its own. It's like a So everything runs by cause and effect laws. It's a big giant thing that runs because it runs that way because it exists that way. If it doesn't exist, it means it wasn't going according to the rules. The rules are not intelligent. There's nothing intelligent about the universe. It isn't kind. It isn't cruel. It isn't compassionate. It's intelligent. It doesn't care. I use this example of gravity. you fall out of a tree, gravity, you can't create a gravity. You can't make a sacrifice. You can't tie a goat up there and say, okay, I'll sacrifice. Don't create gravity, God, you know. When I fall out of the tree, no, ouch. I have faith, perfect faith. Jump, see what happens. The Buddha once talking to Brahmins, who at the time, it was a fairly primitive Hinduism, which basically worshipped the sun god, Surya. And had fire, they built magic fires, you know, fire sacrifices, pouring soma, this magical, milky stuff with honey in it, to make the sun god come up and go down. You know, the usual, the Egyptians did it, the Aztecs did it, the Mayans did it, the usual stuff. And people still, I think, probably do pray for that, you know, let the sun come up and down. It's like praying for the oil to go off the Gulf, right? They're praying, and the Buddha says, well, if I throw a pebble in the water, can you make it rise? No. It's not too much to ask, is it, this little pebble? But you make the sun come up and go down. So the core of Buddhism is self-analysis. Ruthless, ruthless self-analysis. But the ruthless part is only digging through ourselves, you know, body and mind. But the reward is insight and freedom. Freedom from ignorance. And the freedom from ignorance means freedom from stress. So, I got two questions in the chat. That was
a great question.
Well, I like to say yes, no.
How do you worship?
No. No, come on. Worship what?
After your explanation.
You see, this is a shrine, not an altar. It's a shrine just if you go to a cemetery, you have a grave for your grandma, grandpa, mom, or dad, and you take flowers to the graveyard. You're not worshiping them, I hope. People do worship their ancestors, but not usually in the West. But like my mother will go to my father's grave every couple of weeks and she'll, you know, clean it up and put new flowers on there. She's not worshiping things. Respect and remembering them. And this is what a shrine is for. In the time of the Buddha, these didn't come until 400 years after he died. Didn't allow statues to be. Yeah. Bowing is not only, you can ask the Burmese and the Sinhalese people here who are from Buddhist countries, people bow prostrate. Bowing is the Japanese. But a prostration all over Southeast Asia and the Middle East is done to your parents and your teachers. It is not religious. It's a way to show your parents and teachers are on top of your head, the highest respect. And in Thailand, you know, you bow to your, it's probably in Burma too, right? Yeah. You show respect. They have a teacher's day, and all the students come with candles and incense, and they all in mass prostrate to their teachers. You prostrate to your mother and father when they're alive and when they're dead. You go to their grave, you do prostration to them. I put my head on the ground in front of you. You know, it's a natural way, because everybody in Southeast Asia sits on the floor with no furniture like the Japanese. And the way to pay respect, you're sitting already, so the way to extend that bow is a prostration.
Is that every moment is something that's worshiping too, that she actually is, I think, in her life, and trying to get that piece of it. I'm so mindful, so elegant.
You practice. Your practice is your breathing. Your very life becomes your path. So that this is a formal place or in a formal area, but I hope people continue their practice when they leave these doors. Because they're not going to get anywhere if they just come here and say, oh yes, now I feel like practice. This is sort of the distillation of ideas and art and things that, you know, materialize. The practice is materialized, for instance, in a Buddha image. Now in Thailand, as an aside, you can do all the questions anyway, right? In Thailand, when you make a Buddha image, like the gold, little gold one in front, everyone takes the 8 precepts. Everyone dresses in white. They take the 8 precepts. They cannot drink. They can't eat after 12 o'clock. They don't listen to music, they cannot dance, and they cannot sing. To make the image, then when they practice meditation, when they're finished and they feel, okay, now this group is clean, we can now make a Buddha image. Because it's a spiritual thing to make a Buddha image. At least the ones that are done like that one, not the ones that are printed out en masse. They're usually made in Taiwan, the bell, Then the whole ceremony, a little silver is added to the metal, a little piece of gold is added to the metal, and a little copper is added to the metal. And then they put things like little rolled up pieces of scripture, teachings of the Buddha, and maybe some lotus petals. But the whole thing is a spiritual experience. And the carving of the Buddha was done the same way, the mold that was made. And then they pour it, and there's conches being blown, and monks chanting in the background. And the Buddha is born. This image is born. It isn't chisel, no. It's an art, but it's an art that has all this concentration behind it. This intended concentration. They want, when you make something like that, you have to have good intention, pure intention. So, that's everything that's done. It should be done like that. Everything we do in life should be done well and not messy. Doesn't matter if you're washing dishes. Be mindful of what you're doing. That entails so much. In Buddhism, that entails so much. It's not only concentration, but it's wise attention, it's asking the right questions, it's deliberation and taking it apart. It's at the same time, this scientific process that's going on has to have compassion and empathetic joy. It has to have goodwill and equanimity to balance it. Have the mind and equanimity. So all that's going into this thing, you know, just the idea of doing something with goodwill, but at the same time being concentrated, being mindful, being clearly comprehending, paying wise attention on all these things the Buddha talks about all the time. And what does that do? That does everything we do, we must know what we are intending and what our motivation is. And it distills to one question, all of this, and then bounces back and comes out of that one question. Is what I am thinking or saying or doing to my benefit and the benefit of others? If it isn't, don't think it, don't say it, don't do it. And that includes animals. That includes all beings, in other words. How many people, how often do we ask ourselves that question? As we go through life, you know, we argue with this person, we get mad at that person, we get greedy at this, we get impatient, we get... The things we want, the things we chase and desire, are they to our benefit and the benefit of others? If it's just to our benefit and we end there, then we're just narcissistic. If we add on, and is this beneficial for others? then it sobers us. I'm not special. I'm not alone. What I do has repercussions. That one question, if people just said Lindsay Lohan wouldn't go to jail. Sanity might come into the world. And whether it's from a religious point of view or it's from a political point of view, if the Congress would simply ask, is this to my benefit and the benefit of the nation? Honestly ask that question. Just keep going. Keep going. Is this to my benefit and will I be reelected if I do it? Nobody has the backbone. It isn't Republican or Democrat. People have to stop thinking like that. It's just, is this a good person or not? Do they have everybody in mind in their actions? Good or bad, good person or bad person, there's nothing to do with those labels. They're so destructive because it makes everybody stereotype. Whatever this person says, I believe it. That's not good or bad. Whatever that person says, I question it. Well, I weigh it. I judge it. Does this make sense? Will this lead to increased happiness? Or will it lead to increased chaos?
Where do you believe you are in your spiritual journey?
Me?
Yeah.
Personally? Wouldn't you like to know? I have no idea. You can't measure those things anyway. Not like that. You have to get to the end before you know where you were. You know, if you have a measuring tape and you have no end to it, you can't say, well, from this point to the end, how it works the middle. You don't know if there's no, if you've never gone to the end of it. So it's the same in any kind of spiritual practice that until you become enlightened, you're never going to know where you were. Because it's always in the past. You can't know where you are in the past, at the present. You just know, well, it wasn't better than yesterday.
When I wrote these questions, I had read a thing about you.
Oh, okay.
So it was kind of a earlier in the semester kind of thing. So they seemed silly.
Innocence.
Yeah, if they seemed silly, I had thought I just completed an assignment.
No, they're not silly because they teach.
Yeah. Oh, they're helpful for me. Past lives. You guys don't dwell at all on that kind of stuff, correct?
Well, it's not a matter of dwelling on it. It's a matter of you're stuck in it. You're stuck in a past life right now. You are the result of that. But you don't think about it because you can't remember it. So you can't remember yesterday, right? What you did. Yeah. I can't even remember a couple of hours ago. So, we are the sum total of all that you have done, all the decisions you have made, all the choices you have taken, that's what you are right now. The sum total of that. And everybody would agree with that. You're also the sum total of billions of years of evolution as far as body. Those are past lives. Depends on how you look at it. What you do now is what you are going to be in the future, because you're making choices. So yes, you are. Past lives are important because you're the sum total of those things. Now, in Buddhism, there's two ways to look at past life. Since the Buddha was the first one to come up with the theory that the brain runs on impulses, it is not a steady state theory. In other words, the thing they know now, science knows, that it's run by electrical impulses, because there isn't a steady stream of, like an uncut cord, but it's these very, very quick impulses that run the brain. Well, this is the Buddha said that thought runs. Every time a thought arises, persists, and that thought passes, whatever mental impulse, we don't call it thought, Whatever mental impulse arises, persists, and passes, that is birth, life, and death. In the next millisecond, from the dying of the last impulse, another one arises because cause and effect. Without a previous impulse, an impulse would not arise. And that's birth, life, and death. So that's one way he talked about rebirth. You are being literally reborn and dying right now millions of times while you sit here. The other way is to look at the long view, in that you are born as a baby, you grow old, and you die, and your consciousness animates another suitable body, like an impulse. In other words, your last impulse in your body, in your mind, ignites an impulse in another body and might start it all over again. So the circuit is broken. That's the best way to look at it. But nobody thinks about that. And if they do, they're not usually Buddhists. There's a lot of books on, reincarnation, which is not Buddhist, by the way. Reincarnation is Hindu. Rebirth is Buddhism. Because in reincarnation, there is a soul that's reborn. Buddhism doesn't believe in a soul. So it is an entity that's born that's constantly changing and never the same. So when you were 3 years old, what you are now, you're a totally different person. And in the next life, you will be a totally different person. It just keeps going. And you can't at any one point say, this is me, this I am. Because by the time you've said it or thought it, you're not that anymore. So there is a self. There's a being and a self and an ego, but it's impermanent. It isn't determined.
So then you fall under nihilist?
Then? No. It's not annihilated. And when you die, you are not annihilated. But you're not permanent. You're not eternal. he said both of those things don't make sense. They can be, they're not true. And in the end, of course, if you're annihilated, you're not annihilating anything you weren't at the beginning. Nothing to annihilate. It's like saying, when you put out a fire and a candle, where does the flame go? Okay, next question.
Wait, I just want to make sure that you work. I guess probably about the only other one that has education here. What advice could you offer to me?
The one piece of advice I talked about, and that is when you are going to do something, that is just to my benefit. And to be mindful means watch what your mind is doing. So that when you get angry or get afraid or you get stressed, because it does not flow out in words and action. You catch it. You say, no. When I am angry, I will not think, say, or do, because it's in a state where I'm not in control. This is where free will. We interestingly enough, we're very Buddhist in America in civil law, but not in religion. So if a murderer is convicted of murder, they're convicted in degrees, whether it's first degree, second degree, homicide, or it's crimes of passion, or et cetera, et cetera. So someone can actually kill someone and not go to jail because they didn't do it on purpose. Or someone can kill people and say, this is premeditated, which is thought out, which is cold-blooded, and they make it to death sentence. They both killed somebody. That is how mind is. It is not, you cannot have commandments written in stone. That isn't how the mind works at all. Every individual and every act they commit is as different as a fingerprint for that person. And the results will come back as different as a fingerprint. So that karma, karma is the action, vipaka is the result. We tend to get them mixed up in America. We call everything karma. Something happens to us bad, we say, oh, it's my karma. No, it's your vipaka. Karma is the action done. Vipaka is the result. So there's this action and result, action and result. And it's perfectly seeable. It's not book a book of mystery. You don't have to have faith in it. It's like to say, you go, as they say, you know, go to a good Irish bar and go punch a drunk Irishman and see what happens. You know what's going to happen, right? Kama vipaka. If you tell lies, if you steal, if you are insincere, it will catch up with you. You will become a social outcast. You will be not respected. You will not prosper. You will have a lot of stress. It's very simple to see these things that we do, how they come back on us. And that's what karma is, basically. It isn't intelligent. And it isn't tit for tat. But it affects the quality of our happiness and our peace and our calm in either a good way or a bad way, depending on how skillful we are in the actions we do. So I would say the best advice to anybody would be any action, any intentional action that you do, thinking, saying, or do, then you should ask that question. It's just my benefit of that of others. And then you'd be a moral person. And you protect yourself. And you protect others from yourself. Very simple. None of these commandments and memorized guiding force. I mean, we can answer our own questions as to what we're doing is good or bad. Any intelligent person can do that. Places the onus on us. You can't erase it either. Can't go to confession, they go to Catholic. 10 hour vows, 10 Hail Marys, okay, you're, whatever you did, fine. That was pretty nice. I like those days. Bless me, Father, for I am rotten.
Right.
Okay, no, just do this and you'll be fine. The thing is, you know, we learned it. I'm afraid of 10 Our Fathers and 10 Hail Marys. I cheated them, not anyway. But we grew up, you know, we learned this rites and rituals for our first confession. We learned the formula. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. My last confession was a month ago, just almost a month. I quarreled with my brothers and sisters. I disobeyed my mother and father. That was it. And it never changed. And even if I didn't quarrel with them or disobey my mother, I still said the same thing. It was like, blah, 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 on the beach. Okay, I don't remember it. It was like, we were just, the kids lined up were going in like sausages into a grinder, whipping us out there. And we all come out and we'd beat up somebody in the playground. Right? It didn't make sense. But in Buddhism, no, you don't get away with it. No, you earn your happiness and unhappiness. Can't bribe it, can't wash it away. They had all that stuff at the time of the Buddha. It's not something new. Nothing new. Holy water, you know, washing away sins. You still do it if you can, you go take a bath and all your time is washed away. And the Buddha said, well, that means turtles, crocodiles, and fish are the holiest creatures on earth. Why are people eating them? And the Ganges, you could be in the Ganges, you'll see bodies floating by and human waste. Whoa. These are holy bodies. That's where the same holy crap comes. But these things, the Buddha just punched holes in them, and, you know. The Brahmins didn't like him. He wasn't a reformer. He wasn't reforming Hinduism. He threw it out. He just totally destroyed all the philosophies of the time, just wiped them out. And nobody could beat him. Nobody. That's why all of India, all of Southeast Asia became Buddhist, but nobody could beat him. They were terrified of him. He would have these debates with the finest, and he just annihilated them. So Buddhism became it had royal patronage everywhere it went. And yet the other thing that makes him a wonderful Buddha, a Buddha is just a person who rediscovers the truth, teaches it. It's not a god title, a magic title. But he was a good Buddha because he was born upper class and highly educated. So he spoke like a gentleman. He could speak to kings and queens. But he also spoke with the local vernacular, so he could speak to farmers as well. But he was very, very smart as a human being. Very smart. And he was very refined, very educated. He was a gentleman and a prince. That's the combination that works. There's Buddhists in the past and Buddhists in the future that maybe, we call them Prajna Buddhists. They're not able to teach. They're not educated. They don't have vocabulary. So they just become Buddhists on their own and they don't teach. So all Buddhists are slightly different. This one was just the right combination. Question?
You consider yourself a Buddha, or?
No. There's only one Buddha.
I know, I'm sorry.
This is actually a belief in some branches of Buddhism where they call people Buddha and they talk about Buddha nature. This is not Buddha.
You have, words about titles and such. Do you carry any kind of title?
No. Like Buddhism doesn't really have titles. The rank of a monk goes according to their age since ordination. In other words, how long they've been ordained
a monk.
Yeah. So if an 80-year-old man becomes a monk for 1 year, he's 1 year old. And he would have to sit lower and bow to a 22-year-old who's been ordained 2 years. So the whole ranking system is according to how long he's been a monk. They don't have popes and bishops.
What is the goal of meditation?
Well, to take it out of context, there are three things that you have to do. Meditation is one of them. You have to be a moral, good, upright person, which we talked about, which is my benefit brother. In order to meditate, meditation is to still the mind so it doesn't have greed, hatred, and delusion. It's to get all of the biases out of it. So, the third is wisdom, so that wisdom can arise. In other words, so you can look at something without me getting involved. My culture, my genetics, my subconscious, my conscious, my heart wiring, my upbringing, my sex, my age, my race, all that gets into it when you look at it. You show this bell to everybody in this room will have a different idea about this bell. And since it's Tibetan, the Tibetans have a very different idea about it too. What's it for? What does it symbolize? It doesn't have a name. It's just a piece of metal. It doesn't think anything. It has no value whatsoever, any more than this paper. My mind and all of our minds, we give it a value, and we give it symbolism, and we give it magic. It's a Dorje bell, right? It was the Dorje thunderbolt. It's just opening the gates of hell, man. It's just a bell making a silly sound. So we put all of this stuff into it, like a Buddha image. They're cultural things that we project into it. But the thing in and of itself, my mind can never see unless it has no me in the mind. Then it just, okay, it is what it is without value. What is the most valuable thing on earth? Diamonds. What are they made of?
Coal.
Yeah, crushed carbon. What is carbon from? Dead things. So the essence of death is the most valuable thing in human society. Isn't that great? Does it cure diseases? No. Can it be used as some clothing for protection against heat or cold? No. Does it chase away hungry goats? No. Does it corrupt? Yes. to kill, enslave, steal, lie, cheat, for those essence of death. We value those. What is it really? It's carbon. Under high pressure. So it's death. It's dead dinosaurs and trees and muck. Squished, you know, for millions of years, and it becomes this crystallized carbon. There's no value. But we, it is the most valuable thing on earth. What has the mind done? And you can make everybody in the world believe it. I mean, someone gave me a diamond, they would turn it down. I'd go and sell it for something and build another house out of the diamond. You use, it's funny, but it's the truth. You use things, but understand their real value. You can use a diamond. You can use $1 million. Don't let it corrupt you. I will not, because of this pressed carbon, become greedy. I will not kill, steal, cheat, lie for this. It's money becoming rich and hard work and having diamonds and gold and all the bling you can wear on your neck. That's fine. Don't let it corrupt you. And unfortunately, that's almost impossible. To be above, to see things as they are and their true value and be above it all. To be uninfluenced. That's the perfect human being, isn't it? Wouldn't you want that guy as a judge at your trial? The perfect human being. Totally unbiased. Just, you know, not liking or disliking, just being, having compassion, having empathy, but having that equanimity which makes a good judge. This is the kind of people we look for. Where are they? Who are our heroes? Besides Lindsay Lohan. Who are our heroes? Rock stars? Actresses? Actors? People who drive fast cars, people who beat each other up in a ring, people who kick a piece of pigskin around, those are our heroes. Where do you find this person who has this perfect fairness about them, this perfect wisdom, perfectly, this really good, where are they? They're not really admired. They're in our minds as an ideal, but we don't admire people like that. And if you count them on your, you can count them. Where are they in the whole world? Who are these famous people? Where? It's sad, isn't it? How many actors do we name? Oh, we can go through. How many sports, you know, athletes, famous athletes? She's this. How many really wise, wonderful people that are non-biased, you know, have compassion? Well, this is Jesus. But he's dead. Well, okay, let's see. Yeah. The perfect human is not even, that perfectly liberated, just human is not even trying. People didn't try for it. So we're all hypocritical. We all want to go to heaven. Everybody wants to go to heaven. Well, Buddhists don't want to go. Some Buddhists want to go to heaven. We all want to, after we're dead, we want to go to that place. How do we live our lives that we behave really like we want to go to that place? I ask people that because if you want to go to heaven, you know, eternity, right? People who believe in eternity. That's a long time. Not, we can't grasp that, we can't fathom it, we can't understand it, because it's forever. How long is a life, one human lifetime, compared to eternity? It's tiny, right? So can't people behave themselves for one lifetime and trade for eternity? So are people behaving like they really believe they're such a place? No. It's only 65, 70, 80 years. Just behave yourself for that long and you're rewarded for eternity in paradise. sleeping on gold beds and have virgins. Wait, that's the other pyramid. Nice music. I don't know, whatever they have up there, whatever you imagine. For eternity! Now, I can't even, I can't, you know, even for 24 hours, I can't do that. Hypocrisy. Go and live in a cave somewhere and just praise, you know. Sacrifice a bull and a goat and things like that. And the biblical stuff, you know. Just do that for the rest of your life and you guarantee. Guarantee. No, not even 5 minutes. So Buddhism is a path that you can achieve because you watch your progress in yourself all the time, daily. Whereas the other is, after you're dead, you're going to know. Some guy comes up to you and says, I'm going to sell you a used car ad. Oh, wow. And it's only $5. And it's only a year old. Wow, where do I sign? I'll say $5. There has to be a cap. No, no, but you'll get it after you're dead. I'll deliver it when you die. Would you sign for a car like that? No. No. I wouldn't buy insurance that way. I wouldn't buy anything that way. After you're dead, you get it. You get it. I wasn't born yesterday. But apparently, that happens. So the Buddha says, forget about tomorrow. You do this, you work at this, and you will see here and now in the present, you will see progress. And if you don't, return it. Try it. It works. And if it doesn't work, dump it. Dump it. It's got to work. It's got to work in the here and now, in reality, in your real life. It's got to work in your real life in real time. Not somewhere in the future. And you only know after today. Not now. Okay, any last questions? Your question out.
I could probably go all night with you.
Anybody else have any questions? Okay, well, we'll give you time. Meditation is in half an hour, 7 o'clock. Stretch and tea here.